supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll be talking about dollar weed, also known as pennywort. Once the wetness levels move up, this weed may be impossible to move out. We're also going to talk to Andrea de Robillant, author of the new book Chasing the Rose, in which he travels the Venetian countryside trying to track down the secret of his great-great-great-great-grandmother's rose. It's a great book. I think it'll be a great interview. And now we better take some of your great phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Megan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Megan. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. And where is Megan Good?
I'm from Glen Olden, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia?
Yes, right outside.
Okay, what can we do for Megan and Glen Olden?
Well, I have three beautiful hydrangeas that grow in front of my home. And we've been there for 8 years, and they've bloomed every year. I really haven't done any kind of maintenance with the hydrangeas, but this year they're not blooming. They're just the sticks still, no leaves. We have new growth at the bottom, but it looks very strange, and it's not blooming or doing anything.
Okay, but you are certainly not consumed with jealousy from your neighbor's beautiful
hydrangeas. No, my neighbor. That's the only way I keep solace, is that my neighbor two doors down has a hydrangea bush, and hers hasn't bloomed either. So we both kind of keep looking at each other and say, what's going to happen?
Okay, now magnify that situation. Do that thing they do in the cartoons or a TV show where they pull out and make the picture bigger and bigger and bigger and take it down to Washington, D.C., and take it all the way up through New England. I think because we're out of it, because it's finally over, because it failed to kill us, I think people are already negating in some way, mentally, the severity of the winter we just survived. It was horrid. I can remember winters where we got as much snow, but I'm not sure I can remember winters that were as destructive with the various rounds of snow and ice and the freezing cold temperatures. With hydrangeas, you have an interesting situation. There are many types of hydrangeas, but the most common varieties bloom on what's called old wood, which is why you're supposed to leave your hands off them at the end of the season. The wood that looks unattractive over winter is going to produce most, if not all, of the new flowers, whereby, kind of on a biennial thing happening, there's always going to be new green growth at the plant that'll be your, quote, new wood, and that'll provide your blooms the following year, again, for most hydrangeas. Well, I was just like you, and it's funny because I have three of them in a row right in front of my house, too. They've been out there for 15 years. They've survived every winter up to now. And up until mid-May, I didn't even see green growth at the base. So I just left them alone. Then when we saw there was green growth at the base, I went in there and I cleaned out all the leaves that had gotten trapped in there, all the debris, you know, to give the new green growth plenty of room. And then we did a series of cutbacks of the old wood. First, we cut it back by about 6 inches, and we let that sit for like a couple of weeks. Then we recently cut it back by another 6 inches because the wood is green, you know, trying to stimulate some action there. But unfortunately, the fact is all the flower buds were destroyed by frost. So even though that old wood is partially alive, I don't think there's any flowering buds left on it. And the good news, however, is I don't know about yours, but the green growth, the new growth, this year's growth on mine looks exceptionally healthy.
Yeah, mine looks good. So I should just cut it back?
No. I would not do any. I would just kiss it on the lips for not dying completely. And
okay.
Let that new green growth just be itself. Don't feed it with chemical fertilizers. Don't mulch it. If you want to do anything for it, give it a little bit of compost, some natural nutrition. Mm-hmm. I'm still not convinced we won't see a couple of flowers towards the end of the season, but we're not going to see those dazzling big displays like we did last year. What we have the promise of is really good blooms next year. So there's always hope, and I think what you want to do is just leave this green growth alone. Certainly don't do any pruning at the end of the year. And then next season, let's see what they look like. My instinct is the plants are going to bloom better than ever next year.
Yeah, I can't wait.
So sorry about this year, but at least they're not dead.
Yes, that's true.
All right.
Thanks so much, Mike. Yes.
All right. Good luck, Megan.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Conway, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine, Conway. How are you, sir?
I'm fine also.
And where is Conway fine?
In the heart of southern Middle Tennessee, Manchester.
All right. What can we do for Conway in Tennessee?
Mike, I had a nice little fig tree, and you know we had a brutal winter this year, and it died. Well, I've got about three new ones coming up of different heights.
Right.
And I wondered, should I cut all of those but one to get better growth and fruition?
Okay, so your fig tree did not die, Conway. The roots did not die, but the top growth that was exposed to the winter, which I agree was just totally hellish, the top growth died. Now, I realize in Tennessee, you have a fairly moderate climate, but as you learned, during a harsh winter, that fig tree is going to need to be protected.
Yeah, I didn't do that, and I wish I had.
Yeah, well, hindsight is 100%. That's okay. The thing is, especially if you liked the figs, the root system is still fine, and it's growing up from the roots. So you have a couple of choices. Do you still have a lot of dead wood up top? Do you still have the carcass of the main tree?
Yes, it's still standing there.
Okay. Typically with figs, when you start to get the new growth, you're supposed to remove all the winter damaged areas, pruning around to get just healthy figs. Now, of course, 99% of your fig was winter damaged, so that's kind of out there. So all the shoots are coming up out of the ground. There's no shoot coming off of a piece of wood.
No, all the old wood is dead.
Okay, but and it's all the new shoots are coming up literally out of the root system.
That's correct.
Well, then, yes. What I would do before we got any deeper into the summer heat stress is I would suggest digging up the whole schmageggy. You know, getting a bunch of... How big is the tree?
Oh, it's just about 6 feet.
Oh, okay. Get a shovel, dig around it, unearth the roots, and you'll probably find, like you said, three of these shoots coming off the root system. I would divide the root system up into three sections, each with a shoot, and then I would replant those shooted roots.
Right.
Now, don't lose any root material if you can.
Right.
And that way, try it in three different locations. And if you don't want three fig trees after the end of this coming winter, then you start to choose which ones are doing best, which ones suffered the least winter damage, and that'll be the remaining one. The worst that'll happen is you'll have three fig trees.
Right. Okay, Mike. Well, that sounds great.
I think that's an easy answer. And Conway, don't feel bad. This happened to a lot of people. And unlike some other plants that suffered severe winter damage, a lot of the figs did not survive underground. People really lost their entire tree. I mean, because everybody's calling these things dead, and a lot of them have green growth coming, which, you know, means they were almost dead, but they came back. But a lot of people who had their trees in exposed areas, a little colder winter area than you, their fig trees are really most sincerely dead. And that's hard to do. You know how these things will survive even a harsh winter down by the root system.
Right.
So break it into three trees, plant them in three different locations, thin them out over time if you don't want that many fig trees. And if you see one that's doing really good, you don't have to go nuts with wrapping it, but drive some stakes into the ground around it and wrap burlap around the stakes just to break the wind, just to keep the worst of the winter wind from desiccating it.
All right, Mike, I will.
And then prune it in the spring when everything starts to green up again.
Okay, great, Mike.
All right, Conway?
Right, well, thank you very much.
My pleasure, sir. You have a good summer.
And you too.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be doing a free talk on the best ways to turn your yard and garden waste and all those stinky scraps from your kitchen into glorious garden gold at the annual Burlington County Earth Fair in historic Smithville Park on Sunday, June 22nd. Which is tomorrow for our Philadelphia area listeners. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with what to do when dollar weed comes a-calling, more of your fabulous phone calls, and the story of a man's search for his great-great-great-great-grandmother's rose. I'm great-great-great-great Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, whether you call it pennywort or dollar weed, it is a plant that signals excessive wetness in your landscape. We'll tell you what to do with these play money plants when we get to the question of the week. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to get to a very special interview with Andrea de Robillant, author of the new book, Chasing the Rose, An Adventure in the Venetian Countryside. Andrea, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Mike. It's a thrill to be here.
It's a thrill to have you. I discovered your book almost by accident when I was going through, you know, we get a million books in here about gardening and stuff, and I was trying to pick books that I would enjoy during a trip to Cuba, which I took in January. And I thought, well, this seems to be a kind of a travelogue, too. So I took it along with me, and I was charmed, delighted, and probably learned more about roses from you, an avowed amateur.
An avowed amateur, absolutely.
Than I did in a lot of books written by rose professionals. And I've come to believe that intelligent people who seek out something can explain it better often than people who've lived in it all their lives.
Well, I think there's a point in that. I must say that I did, as you say, I didn't really know much about roses at all when I started out on this quest to find the identity of this mysterious rose. And so I did feel like a bit of an imposter often when I was actually confronted with expert rosarians and I would be seeking their advice. I felt a little out of place. And I think you have a point in saying that, people who don't really know much about things then are better at explaining them.
Yes, and your search, your journey is so fascinating, and it touches people on so many levels, in so many ways. You're going home, you're finding your ancestry, but you're also learning a lot of cool things about roses that I don't think a lot of rosarians even know.
I'm still not an expert in roses, but I've learned enough. I mean, in the course of this journey, I have learned enough to make this whole world very wonderful and fascinating to me.
Chasing the Rose is a fun read, and it's one of these books that's dog-eared, not because I've read it over and over again, but because I want to keep being able to save pages to go back to and refer to. Now, lead our listeners into this, because just your raison for this is so fascinating. You were looking for information about a specific rose that goes back how far in your family?
Well, it was about 200 some years. But I didn't really go out to look for this rose. The rose came to me one day when I was exploring an old family estate that had not been in the family for over 100 years. And then I was taken by a sort of soi-disant caretaker in the woods behind the estate. And there he showed me this lovely silvery pink rose that was extraordinarily fragrant and that was growing wild in these woods, as if a secret garden had sprung up mysteriously in the woods. And he asked me, as a descendant of the family that had lived there long ago, if I had any inkling of what this rose could be. And of course I didn't. But that was the beginning of the quest, really.
And then you set off to find more about it, and Marie Antoinette enters the picture?
Josephine enters the picture, in the sense that I did start looking around, and I think another discovery that was fundamental for me was a diary that my great-great-great-great-grandmother, Lucia Mocenigo, had kept during her time in Paris. During her stay in Paris, she had become very close friends with Empress Josephine. Now, Empress Josephine wasn't Empress anymore because she had divorced Napoleon in 1810, but she was famous for her extraordinary garden at Malmaison, where she lived. And Lucia became very close to her and literally spent every weekend at her house looking and learning at the plants and the roses in her garden. You know, right there at that time, Paris was going through a real rose craze. Rosomanie is the term they used. And Josephine was very much at the center of this. She was a formidable force behind the development of roses in the first part of the 19th century. And so when Lucia, my ancestor, returned to Italy, she came back not with just her luggage, but also a carriage filled with plants and roses and seeds and so on. And so she planted an extraordinary rose garden at her house in the Venetian countryside. And, of course, all of this had long disappeared. And the only remnant of Lucia's Parisian story, of Parisian stay, was this silvery pink rose that grew mysteriously in the wood. But nobody knew what it was, and nobody knew its connection and its history. And so discovering this diary that I found in the archives, in which Lucia told all these stories about her Parisian stay, I was able at least to find out where the rose had come from. But still, I had no idea what the rose was, but I certainly at this point was rather eager to get to the bottom of the mystery.
And remind me now, how did this lead you to one of my favorite couples in all of modern literature? And you know exactly who I mean.
You mean Eleonora and Valentino?
What? I mean, they jump off the page, Andrew.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, they're two remarkable people. Eleonora Garlant and her husband Valentino. They have an extraordinary garden in northern Friuli, which is the region above the Venetian coastline. She's known in the area as the Rose Lady. She has a prodigious knowledge about old roses, and she has a remarkable garden. It has over 1,500 species and varieties, only old roses. And, of course, Valentino, her husband, is the one who planted them all around these beautiful three vegetable plots. And so the magic of this garden really is its mix of rusticity and extreme sophistication. In other words, you're in the countryside, you are among vegetables, but then you're also surrounded by the most sophisticated roses in the world. But the most remarkable thing about her garden, actually, is the fact that every year, five or six natural hybrids come to life in her garden. Now, natural hybrids do occur in nature, not very often, but they do occur. The remarkable thing is that in her garden, it occurs all the time. Every year, five or six natural hybrids that are the product of liaisons between two roses in her garden come to life there.
Let me stop you and just make it clear to our listeners that we're talking about an elderly couple struggling to maintain. At least Valentino is struggling through.
Well,
the
I mean,
book.
They're both in their 70s. Yeah, so
struggling to maintain the vegetable garden that's, of course, such a big part of life in that part of the world. And then these wild roses, these hoodlum roses that are like third cousins to your mysterious rose.
Yeah.
And every season, a new variety of rose springs up 5, 6, 7, maybe 20 times in this little garden. A rose unknown up until then.
Yeah, well, 5 or 6 roses unknown every year. So if you take just a time frame of 10 years, that makes 60 unknown roses that come to life in her garden. You can only see them in her garden because she's not in the business of trading them.
And she says in the book, quote, "There is nothing but the blood of old roses running through
yes,
their veins."
Of course, yeah. And I must say, these roses, these spontaneous hybrids, are so remarkable, are so beautiful that they can stand up comparison to some of the great roses of the 19th century. They're just remarkable.
So a bee goes to one old rose and visits it and gets some
and
nectar and gathers some pollen. Then goes to another one, and he takes that pollen, and he pollinates the other rose's flower. Eventually, a hip forms, which is the seeds of the rose, and typically would, in most modern gardens, fall to the ground and just be eaten by mice or rot or something. But there's a bird involved in this garden.
Exactly. He plays a crucial role, I think. The garden is filled with hawfinches, and they tend to eat the bud and then digest the seeds and then leave droppings in other parts of the garden. But the sort of magical side of this is that I went to consult expert in botanical studies, and I said, okay, but is this all, or is there something else at work here? And one of the people I consulted, who's now rather, a luminary, who is now quite famous and who's done a lot of work on the intelligence of plants, told me that actually it is Eleonora herself that by her presence and by her communicating with the roses in very special ways, she has created a, what can we call it, a perfect environment for roses to couple and create new varieties. And this botanist told me, you know, I wouldn't be telling my colleagues this. there's something more magical than scientific, but I think it is true in this case.
That's when the science begins to get interesting.
Absolutely, yeah.
As we're proceeding through this book, which is just delightful, all of a sudden, a descendant of the author of The Little Prince shows up.
Well, that was totally unexpected, yeah.
It was, you think?
It was during a conference, and we'd managed to invite a very famous rose expert, French expert, called Monsieur Joyeux, and we had invited him to Italy to see the rose that we were trying to identify, the Rosa Mocenigo that we had found in the woods behind our family house. And so we had finally managed to invite this very prominent expert to come. And he, in fact, was sort of crucial in the quest to find the flower. But during the weekend in which we were together, a French gentleman appeared and said that he was the grandnephew of Saint-Exupéry, the author of The Little Prince. And he had come to speak about the origins of the rose on the asteroid of the little prince. And he engaged us in wonderful conversation about who the rose really was and who all the women who had claimed to be the rose on the asteroid of the little prince. And it was just a wonderful little touch and an addition to this quest, and one of the many interesting people I met along the path.
But hardly a tangent, because the whole book, if you look at it one way, is you trying to figure out what your rose was.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's the core of the quest. Of course, along the way, I had no idea whether I would succeed in this, in the sense that things were looking pretty grim. Nobody was helping me. I couldn't find any documents. I couldn't find any person who would guide me to the answer of this. But then, towards the end of this journey, things happen, and I'm suddenly taken to places and meet one wonderful person who really helps me out to find and make the final connection.
And did you feel that this closed a loop for you? Did you feel closer to your ancestors? I can only imagine it would be like looking through an old piece of furniture and finding a hidden compartment with a ring in it, and somebody appraises it and says it's 300 years old, and then you never need anything else in your mind the rest of your life to wonder about the stories that you can come up with.
Well, in a way, but then you do move on to the next story. But I thought that that the story had an ending, and it was a good ending, and I had been able to identify this rose, to figure out where it had come from. And so I felt comfortable. But at the same time, it was the rose that had enabled me to go on this journey and to make an education for myself and to connect with my own ancestry and my own heritage. So,
and in a world where we worry about the decreasing diversity, isn't it really joyous to think about the possibilities of other lost plants? They're not gone. They're truly just lost. They're in the woods somewhere. They're in the ruins of an old abbey, just waiting for the right person to pot them up and take them to Valentino.
Yeah, but I think right now we're going through a movement not dissimilar from what was going on in Paris in the early 19th century, of tremendous interest, renewed interest for roses, a new rosomania, as it were. And this means that a lot of people are going out and looking for these lost roses, trying to reconnect them. And it's certainly not easy. It's certainly not easy to find what their true identity is. But a lot of those roses are being brought in, and as it were, from the wilderness and taken care of.
And it may not be easy, but I get a sense from your book that it's incredibly satisfying. When you...
Oh, my God, yes, absolutely. As I said, one of the most charming places in her garden is this area where you see all these, she calls them her orphan roses. And by God, they certainly have a lot of personality.
Well, as does your book, as I'm sure you do in person. Andrea de Robillant has been our guest. He's the author of the brand new book, Chasing the Rose, An Adventure in the Venetian Countryside. He came to us today through the very kind auspices of WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. I want to thank everyone involved for bringing this interview together. Andrea, I want to thank you for writing the book, Chasing the Rose. It's one of my new favorites.
Thank you so much, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind lawn owners who have a cool season grass like fescue or bluegrass that we have entered the no-feeding zone. Cool season lawns should be fed in spring and fall, but never in the summer. Another easy way to keep that grass green is to not mow it during a dry heat wave. Wait until the weather breaks to avoid taxing your turf. But don't go looking for all the details under the letter L for lawns in the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fascinating phone calls and how to make some change out of dollar weed. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for WHYY's You Bet Your Garden is made possible by Burpee. Burpee is committed to providing all things needed for planting and growing your garden. Seeds, plants, supplies, videos, and more are online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Some people call it pennywort. Some people call it dollar weed. Everyone needs to know that it is a weed that signals conditions of excessive wetness, the kind of wetness that'll kill your wanted plants but allow this one to thrive. We'll tell you how to make change out of dollar weed after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Peggy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I listen to your show, and I'm a great devotee, and I have a squirrel and bird problem in my garden, which is happens to be near the Art Museum in Philadelphia. I was going to try to get netting to cover. I have apple, Asian pear, the peach, and the fig that sort of just died, so that would be too big to cover. I Googled netting, and there were some complaints about trying to throw nets over these large or any trees, anything. They said if you have buttons on your shirt, it's going to catch. So I want to know what your advice is for protecting. I have to ask you another question.
Well, sort of, wait a minute. First of all, I can solve your first problem with one line. Wear a T-shirt, you know. I mean, come on.
No, I agree with you. Those were just the minimal complaints. But let me ask you something. I just ordered something called a scarecrow, which when a squirrel goes into a tree, it's on like automatic pilot, and you hitch it up to your hose, and it will elicit a spray. And then you just said in last week's gardening program, you said for sure don't get water on the leaves of your vegetables. So I just said to my husband, uh-oh, I'm just ordered this scarecrow that's going to be spraying the whole thing to get rid of squirrels. Did I make a mistake?
No. I could not harvest peaches or keep my lousy cats out of my raised beds without my scarecrow, which is a motion-activated sprinkler. You hook it up to your hose. It has an impact sprinkler on the top. You point it where you want it to protect. And when a deer or a cat or a dog or an evil squirrel or a thieving neighbor goes into your trees, it hits them with a couple of cups of cold water. Now, should you ever wet the leaves of your plants in the evening, especially during a year that so far has been unnaturally cool and wet? Well, technically, no. But technically, you'd probably like to eat some of those peaches and plums
yes,
as well. So it's a balancing act is really what it comes down to. You can't get everything perfect. And this is a great non-toxic defense. What I really like about these motion-activated sprinklers, too, is unlike animal repellents, they're not going to change the flavor of your food. You don't have to keep buying them to spray over and over again. So it's like risk-benefit. You're taking the slight risk of, yes, wetting your leaves in the evening, which nature does an awful lot of the time. But the benefit is it's one of the only things that can keep evil squirrels out of fruit trees.
Really? It's the only thing? For example, some other people I said, when I mentioned netting, they said, oh, boy, they're going to chew through the netting, and then you're going to catch some cute little birds underneath, and it's going to just tried to dissuade me from putting any netting at all.
I have a friend who has a big patch of blueberries, and I go over there and help him pick during the high season. We have had to free the occasional bird who got stuck in the netting, but the collateral damage is minimal. And these birds, no offense, these birds are trying to eat your food. The problem is with squirrels who can get under any kind of netting and, yes, can chew through it and are just plain evil. So, you know, in commercial agriculture, bird netting is absolutely necessary for blueberries and for cherries. Squirrels are only an occasional pest to tree fruits, but when they are, they can strip them.
Well, I appreciate your advice, and I listen to you faithfully, and I knew I had to get your good advice about the netting and this automated squirter.
I would do both. I would try some netting. Just remember, you have to hang the netting on a support, because if the netting rests on the fruits, the birds will just sit on the netting and eat the fruits. So you want to support your netting. You want to have it hanging just above the tree. Some people will make a kind of a rugged cage out of stakes and netting so that nothing is touching the actual fruits. Hang the netting, aim the scarecrow, and light a candle to the Blessed Mother.
All right. I'm going to have to buy more scarecrows.
And more candles, yeah. All right, Peg, good luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Joe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Joe. How are you?
Oh, pretty good.
And where is Joe doing pretty good?
South Fountain, Ohio.
Oh, and where is that in Ohio?
It's about 50 miles northwest of Columbus.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Joe in Ohio?
I got a redbud tree that we bought, I think, planted it about 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it never budded out first couple of years, which I didn't really expect it to. And then it did bud out, and I thought, well, good, now we're going to start getting a pretty tree in the springtime. And then last year, it didn't bud out at all. It just went straight from, dormant to leaves.
Right.
And then watched it again this year. And then I did put fertilizer down after I saw it didn't bud last year. And then this year, it didn't bud again.
Okay, so let's...
Well, what was weird is it didn't bud before I'd ever done any kind of fertilizer to it. So I don't know what's going on.
Okay, so you planted it personally.
Yeah.
Was it bald or burlapped or in a pot?
I think it was in a pot.
Okay, so in other words, it wasn't buried with the wrappings underneath.
No.
Good,
no.
Good. Is it growing in or near a treated lawn?
Well, I mean, it's not treated lawn, but yeah, it's like in a flower bed and then the yard's right there.
But you're not using herbicides on the lawn?
No.
Okay.
No.
Is the tree mulched?
It wasn't, but this year I had all the beds mulched here just a couple weeks ago.
Just to cause more trouble for yourself. What color's the mulch you had?
Black mulch.
Okay. You have to be aware that there could be toxic elements in there.
Okay.
I don't like wood mulch at all, but if you're getting into the colored mulches, you're really asking for trouble. But none of this happened. You didn't do any of this before you had. And in 6 years, you've only seen the thing bloom twice. Is that correct?
Really? Just that 1 year. I think it didn't bloom for 2 years. Then it did bloom, and then it hasn't for...
Right.
And that, but then the other thing, just to let you know, is last year it grew a lot, probably 2 foot on all the branches.
Okay, good.
Stretched way out. But this year, all that growth, there's no leaves on it. It's like all the tips, all the branches that are now 2 foot long, they're all just dead.
And that's just this year?
Yeah, that's just this year.
Okay. That could be winter damage. It was a very severe winter.
Oh, yeah.
If this was the first time it hadn't bloomed, I would have suggested that the buds froze on it like they did on my gold dust plant and a lot of people's hydrangeas. Have you pruned this tree?
No, I've never done any pruning.
Yeah. And how tall is this tree?
About 10 feet tall.
Okay. And it's like 6, 7, 8 years old at this point.
Yeah, about seven.
Okay. Is it clear at the base? Does it have a little bit of room around the trunk, or is it crowded with other plants?
No, it's clear.
Okay, good. And about how much sun a day does it get?
I mean, it gets quite a bit of sun.
Okay.
I mean, until from, say, 4 o'clock on, I guess the sun would be far enough west. There's a tree on the west side of the house.
Okay, so you're
shaded out.
You're saying it gets sun until 4 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
That's fine. All right. No more blood meal. Get rid of the blood meal. Get rid of the black mulch around this tree. Red buds they're not really fragile trees, but nothing really likes this dyed black mulch. And we've had reports of the oils dripping off of it. So get it away from this tree that's already not doing what you want it to do. And I want you to go to a good garden center and get a product called Rock Phosphate. You'll get it in a little bag, and it'll have numbers on the label. It'll probably say something like 030. And what you do is give somewhere between a half a cup and a cup of Rock Phosphate around the base of the plant. Do this now. Do this as soon as possible. And when you get the Rock Phosphate down, which is a natural mined mineral, cover that with an inch of soil or compost. That is the nutrient that encourages blooms. And these blooms, they occur early in the spring, so they're set late in the summer, and they persist over winter, and then they open up in the spring, like forsythia, very similar pattern. So
oh, okay.
you said you didn't prune it. Pruning in the fall would remove the blooms and you'd never see any red buds. But give it the rock phosphate. Don't prune it. And with a mild winter, you should see great blooms again.
Okay. And I just have to put that rock phosphate on it just one time?
Oh, yeah. It lasts. If you get good results, don't put any more down for another 3 or 5 years.
Okay.
All right, Joe?
Sounds good. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck, sir. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Pennywort, dollar weed, and other woes of wetness. Alexis Landis, please read us this week's damp question.
Sure, Mike. Mary in Beaufort, North Carolina writes, my gardens and lawn are being taken over by pennywort. How can I get rid of it? Our yard has a lot of toads, lizards, tree frogs, butterflies, and hummingbirds, so I don't want to use anything toxic. I have tried to control it with Roundup, but nothing kills this stuff. Help!
Well, unfortunately, that Roundup may have been the most toxic option for this specific situation. Research by Dr. Rick Relia of the University of Pittsburgh has shown Roundup to be deadly to amphibians like those frogs and toads. But it's no surprise that our listener has both a yard full of amphibians and, quote, pennywort, a plant that might be better known to you as dollar weed. A bulletin from the Clemson University Extension Service describes it, quote, as a water-loving plant that can float, and explains that its mere presence indicates excessive moisture in the area. Heck, the prefix of its scientific name is even hydro.
I knew that too much water can kill plants, but it actually encourages a weed?
Yeah, and those two points combine to create the worst-case scenario in these situations. The extreme moisture levels that encourage these kind of weeds are also going to weaken just about every desirable plant in the area, especially lawn grasses.
Can reducing the moisture get rid of the weed completely?
Ha! Nothing can. Millie Davenport, the Clemson Extension agent who wrote the bulletin, wisely states that complete eradication is essentially impossible, even with toxic herbicides. The achievable goal, she notes, is to knock it back to a tolerable level.
And will better drainage do that?
It's absolutely the first step. Research performed at the University of Florida demonstrated a reduction in dollar weed just by reducing the frequency of watering. Quote, monitoring moisture levels and evaluating irrigation frequency are the first steps to controlling dollar weed.
Okay, so what does that mean in English?
It means turn off your sprinklers. Don't water if it rained recently. And it especially means to follow the rules of wise watering we've been harping on for the past 16 years.
Don't water if you've had an inch of rain within the week. Only water deeply but infrequently. And always let your plants dry out between waterings.
Very good. Now, most sources, including Clemson, agree that the best control in lawns is also to start taking care of the lawn correctly.
Gee, where have I heard that before?
I think that loud guy with a funny accent on the radio keeps saying it. So in a northern lawn, that would mean never cutting below 3 inches, feeding only in the spring and fall, always returning the clippings to the lawn, and when water-loving weeds like this are present, core aerating in late summer, early fall to improve the drainage.
Right, but our listener is in North Carolina.
Where she could still have a cool season lawn. But more likely it's a warm season variety like St. Augustine or Bermuda grass. In that case, she should cut it at the recommended height for her specific variety, which is generally going to be around 2 to 2.5 inches. She should only feed during the warm months and aerate, but in the spring to early summer.
And in flower beds?
Again, first thing is you got to cut back on the watering. Then you pull, whack, and mulch, working small sections at a time to try and regain control. And, you know, because her area sounds so wet, she might want to look at modifying her layout to a rain garden design, where the beds and lawn will become much less waterlogged, but there'll still be nice wet spots for her aquatic wildlife.
All right, well, let's squeeze in a similarly soggy question from Mary in Moorhead City, North Carolina, who writes, our property is marsh on two sides. It's my parents' old house, so I know for certain that the water is rising, or the rest of the town is sinking. We get fiddler crabs in the yard. We used to have a beautiful St. Augustine lawn, but the dollar weed is taking over. It even grows where it gets a saltwater bath twice a day. The only good thing is that our Chesapeake Bay retriever eats the roots I pull out. She holds the plant between her paws and eats it like spaghetti. Very funny to see. Anyway, how does someone with very little time and money to spend get the dang dollar weed out? Is there a commercial market for this stuff? Is it edible?
Actually, it is said to be edible. Just be sure you've made a correct plant identification and don't harvest it from potentially polluted waters. But more to the point in this soggy situation, that St. Augustine is out. It's a plant of the past for them. Dollar weed is in, and it's one of the few things that her rising water levels are going to allow to grow there. And you know, for many people, it's actually a first choice for wet areas. To quote Timber Press's Encyclopedia of Water Garden Plants, there is something cheerful about a plant that remains green from spring through fall and whose serrated leaves look like smiles connected at the corners. Well, that sure was an interesting look at a so-called weed that thrives in wetness, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to aerate my turf if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore. At garden@whyy.org. That is, of course, provided you tell us where you live in that email.
Oh, please, please, please tell us. It's so important.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's webpage wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our new production assistant is Trisha Whiting. Welcome, Trisha. Our hired hand is still Matt Hudecki. I'm your host, all wet, Mike McGrath, and I'm going to see if I can get pennies and dollars to grow all over me before I see you again next week. What can you do when your child's school is spraying herbicides all around? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how they can easily choose to control unwanted plants without poisons. Plus your fabulous phone calls.